Chapter 8. Stair's rather stiff work was carried up by Barbox brothers. The dinner was a most transcendent success, and the Barbox sheepishness, under Polly's directions how to mince her meat for her, and how to diffuse gravy over the plate with a liberal and equal hand, was another fine sight. "And now," said Polly, "while we are at dinner, you be good, and tell me that story I taught you." With the tremors of a civil service examination upon him, and very uncertain indeed, not only as to the epoch at which the pie appeared in history, but also as to the measurements of that indispensable fact, Barbox Brothers made a shaky beginning, but under encouragement did very fairly. There was a want of breadth observable in his rendering of the cheeks, as well as the appetite, of the boy, and there was a certain tameness in his fairy, referable to an undercurrent of desire to account for her. Still, as the first lumbering performance of a good-humored monster, it passed muster. "I told you to be good," said Polly, "and you are good, ain't you?" "I hope so," replied Barbox Brothers. Such was his deference that Polly, elevated on a platform of sofa cushions in a chair at his right hand, encouraged him with a pat or two on the face from the greasy bowl of her spoon, and even with a gracious kiss. In getting on her feet upon her chair, however, to give him this last reward, she toppled forward among the dishes, and caused him to exclaim, as he effected a rescue, "Gracious angels! Whew! I thought we were in the fire, Polly!" "What a coward you are, ain't you?" said Polly when replaced. "Yes, I am rather nervous," he replied. "Whew! Don't, Polly! Don't flourish your spoon, or you'll go over sideways. Don't tilt up your legs when you laugh, Polly, or you'll go over backwards. Whew! Polly, Polly, Polly," said Barbox Brothers, nearly succumbing to despair, "we are environed with dangers." Indeed, he could descry no security from the pitfalls that were yawning for Polly, but in proposing to her, after dinner, to sit upon a low stool. "I will, if you will," said Polly. So, as peace of mind should go before all, he begged the waiter to wheel aside the table, bring a pack of cards, a couple of footstools, and a screen, and close in Polly and himself before the fire, as it were in a snug room within the room. Then, finest sight of all, was Barbox Brothers on his footstool, with a pint decanter on the rug, contemplating Polly as she built successfully, and growing blue in the face with holding his breath, lest he should blow the house down. "How you stare, don't you?" said Polly in a houseless pause. Detected in the ignoble fact, he felt obliged to admit, apologetically, "I am afraid I was looking rather hard at you, Polly." "Why do you stare?" asked Polly. "I cannot," he murmured to himself, "recall why." "I don't know, Polly. You must be a simpleton to do things, and not know why, mustn't you?" said Polly. In spite of which reproof, he looked at the child again intently, as she bent her head over her card structure, her rich curls shading her face. "It is impossible," he thought, "that I can ever have seen this pretty baby before. Can I have dreamed of her? In some sorrowful dream?" He could make nothing of it. So he went into the building trade as a journeyman under Polly, and they built 3 stories high, 4 stories high, even 5. "I say, who do you think is coming?" asked Polly, rubbing her eyes after tea. He guessed. "The waiter?" "No," said Polly, "the dustman. I am getting sleepy." A new embarrassment for Barbox Brothers. "I don't think I am going to be fetched tonight," said Polly. "What do you think?" He thought not either. After another quarter of an hour, the dustman not merely impending, but actually arriving, recourse was had to the Constantinopolitan chambermaid, who cheerily undertook that the child should sleep in a comfortable and wholesome room, which she herself would share. "And I know you will be careful, won't you?" said Barbox Brothers, as a new fear dawned upon him, "that she don't fall out of bed?" Polly found this so highly entertaining that she was under the necessity of clutching him round the neck with both arms as he sat on his footstool picking up the cards, and rocking him to and fro, with her dimpled chin on his shoulder. "Oh, what a coward you are, ain't you?" said Polly. "Do you fall out of bed?" "And not generally, Polly. No more do I." With that, Polly gave him a reassuring hug or two to keep him going, and then giving that confiding mite of a hand of hers to be swallowed up in the hand of the Constantinopolitan chambermaid, trotted off, chattering, without a vestige of anxiety. He looked after her, at the screen removed and the table and chairs replaced, and still looked after her. He paced the room for half an hour. "A most engaging little creature, but it's not that. A most winning little voice, but it's not that. That has much to do with it, but there is something more. How can it be that I seem to know this child? What was it she imperfectly recalled to me when I felt her touch in the street, and, looking down at her, saw her looking up at me? Mr. Jackson!" With a start he turned towards the sound of the subdued voice, and saw his answer standing at the door. "Oh, Mr. Jackson, do not be severe with me. Speak a word of encouragement to me, I beseech you. You are Polly's mother." "Yes. Yes. Polly herself might come to this, one day. As you see what the rose was in its faded leaves, as you see what the summer growth of the woods was in their wintry branches, so Polly might be traced one day, in a careworn woman like this, with her hair turned gray. Before him were the ashes of a dead fire that had once burned bright. This was the woman he had loved. This was the woman he had lost. Such had been the constancy of his imagination to her, so had time spared her under its withholding, that now, seeing how roughly the inexorable hand had struck her, his soul was filled with pity and amazement. He led her to a chair, and stood leaning on a corner of the chimney-piece, with his head resting on his hand, and his face half averted. "Did you see me in the street, and show me to your child?" he asked. "Yes." "Is the little creature, then, a party to deceit?" "I hope there is no deceit. I said to her, 'We have lost our way, and I must try to find mine by myself.' Go to that gentleman, and tell him you are lost. You shall be fetched by and by. Apostrophe perhaps you have not thought how very young she is. She is very self-reliant. Perhaps because she is so young." He asked, after a short pause, "Why did you do this?" "Oh, Mr. Jackson, do you ask me? In the hope that you might see something in my innocent child, to soften your heart towards me. Not only towards me, but towards my husband." He suddenly turned about, and walked to the opposite end of the room. He came back again with a slower step, and resumed his former attitude, saying, "I thought you had emigrated to America?" "We did. But life went ill with us there, and we came back." "Do you live in this town?" "Yes. I am a daily teacher of music here. My husband is a bookkeeper. Are you, forgive my asking, poor? We earn enough for our wants. That is not our distress. My husband is very, very ill of a lingering disorder. He will never recover, you check yourself. If it is for want of the encouraging word you spoke of, take it from me. I cannot forget the old time, Beatrice." "God bless you," she replied with a burst of tears, and gave him her trembling hand. "Compose yourself." "I cannot be composed, if you are not, for to see you weep distresses me beyond expression. Speak freely to me. Trust me." She shaded her face with her veil, and after a little while spoke calmly. Her voice had the ring of Polly's. "It is not that my husband's mind is at all impaired by his bodily suffering, for I assure you that is not the case. But in his weakness, and in his knowledge that he is incurably ill, he cannot overcome the ascendancy of one idea. It preys upon him, embitters every moment of his painful life, and will shorten it." She stopping, he said again, "Speak freely to me. Trust me. We have had 5 children before this darling, and they all lie in their little graves. He believes that they have withered away under a curse, and that it will blight this child like the rest. Under what curse? Both I and he have it on our conscience, that we tried you very heavily, and I do not know but that, if I were as ill as he, I might suffer in my mind as he does. This is the constant burden. I believe, Beatrice, I was the only friend that Mr. Jackson ever cared to make, though I was so much his junior. The more influence he acquired in the business, the higher he advanced me, and I was alone in his private confidence. I came between him and you, and I took you from him. We were both secret, and the blow fell when he was wholly unprepared. The anguish it caused a man so compressed must have been terrible, the wrath it awakened ineffaceable. So, a curse came to be invoked on our poor, pretty little flowers, and they fall. And you, Beatrice, he asked, when she had ceased to speak, and there had been a silence afterwards, how say you? Until within these few weeks I was afraid of you, and I believed that you would never, never forgive. Until within these few weeks, he repeated. Have you changed your opinion of me within these few weeks? Yes. For what reason? I was getting some pieces of music in a shop in this town, when, to my terror, you came in. As I veiled my face and stood in the dark end of the shop, I heard you explain that you wanted a musical instrument for a bedridden girl. Your voice and manner were so softened, you showed such interest in its selection, you took it away yourself with so much tenderness of care and pleasure, that I knew you were a man with a most gentle heart. Oh, Mr. Jackson, Mr. Jackson, if you could have felt the refreshing rain of tears that followed for me. Was Phoebe playing at that moment on her distant couch? He seemed to hear her. I inquired in the shop where you lived, but could get no information. As I had heard you say that you were going back by the next train, but you did not say where, I resolved to visit the station at about that time of day, as often as I could, between my lessons, on the chance of seeing you again. I have been there very often, but saw you no more until today. You were meditating as you walked the street, but the calm expression of your face emboldened me to send my child to you. And when I saw you bend your head to speak tenderly to her, I prayed to God to forgive me for having ever brought a sorrow on it. I now pray to you to forgive me, and to forgive my husband. I was very young, he was young too, and, in the ignorant hardihood of such a time of life, we don't know what we do to those who have undergone more discipline. You generous man! You good man! So to raise me up and make nothing of my crime against you. For he would not see her on her knees, and soothed her as a kind father might have soothed an erring daughter, thank you, bless you, thank you. When he next spoke, it was after having drawn aside the window curtain and looked out a while. Then he only said, is Polly asleep? Yes. As I came in, I met her going away upstairs, and put her to bed myself. Leave her with me for tomorrow, Beatrice, and write me your address on this leaf of my pocketbook. In the evening I will bring her home to you, and to her father. *** Hello, cried Polly, putting her saucy sunny face in at the door next morning when breakfast was ready. I thought I was fetched last night. So you were, Polly, but I asked leave to keep you here for the day, and to take you home in the evening. Upon my word, said Polly. You are very cool, ain't you? However, Polly seemed to think it a good idea, and added, I suppose I must give you a kiss, though you are cool. The kiss given and taken, they sat down to breakfast in a highly Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.